Thanks, Jenny. Thanks to the organisers for asking me to speak. The bulk of this talk has been prepared by Lucette, so I want to give her credit. I've done some editing. Let's kick off.
Green button with the arrow.
Got it. So HIV and ageing clearly is an important aspect in Australia. It's a topic that is on everyone's radar screens, and I don't need to remind people here. So almost over a decade ago now, I gave a talk at ASHAM on the potential for accelerated brain ageing in the context of neurodegenerative diseases. And I thought this slide was interesting because it sort of conceptualizes a lot of the processes. So any sort of neurodegenerative disease, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all has a common broad pathway. You have a pathogenic insult, misfolded proteins, they then generally lead to an inflammatory response. There's cellular defense failure from a variety of mechanisms, heat shock proteins, autophagy, etc. That in turn then causes inflammation, mitochondrial dysfunction, excitotoxicity, oxidative stress, and ultimately the cell dies. HIV affects almost all of those steps. Aging then is a superimposed factor at those three steps in the middle almost. And then we have potential antiretroviral toxicity. Not all antiretrovirals, but some. And the whole issue of antiretroviral neurotoxicity, I think, is still open. So with that in mind then, what's the status in terms of aging? Well, if you draw the cut point at 50, which is a bit disturbing, then by 2027, at least half, no matter how you cut the data, of our patients will be old by that criterion. If you look at our own data, at least at St Vincent's in Sydney, you can see that there are quite a number of patients. If you're a little bit more rigid and say 60 plus, you're looking at several hundred patients. And we've even got a few out to 80, and I've got one patient who's 90 with neurological impairment, which is a mixed bag. So the numbers for females, of course, are much less, fortunately. What sort of comorbidities are we seeing? I'm sure this has been covered by other speakers, but in broad terms, cancers, cardiovascular disease, bone disease, and there are neurological complications as well. And there are the rates do vary according to the study, and that variation is a consequence of the population that you look at. There are some factors that influence those data. Those comorbidity burdens are reflected in a number of larger studies from Kathy Patumanos and PLOS One. The number of comorbidities increases significantly as you get older, not surprisingly. And this is borne out internationally with the French data showing, again, a broad range of comorbidities that are age-associated more significantly in patients who are HIV positive. The same with the Canadian data that have been published recently. So it's not a surprise. But then the whole issue of what is a comorbidity, I think, is an open question, because I can't really find an adequate, consistent definition of what is a comorbid condition. It's sort of implied that it's self-evident, but that's not necessarily the case. And so that's a methodological issue. And then the next issue is, clearly, we've got a burden of comorbidities as we get older, but how do you weight them? And certainly when you get up around 3-4 comorbidities, you're looking at a number of issues, not just the number of comorbid conditions, but how they interact with each other. At St Vincent's, just to give you an idea, we've looked at some of our data, and the comorbid burden, as you'd expect, is mainly cardiovascular disease, followed by cancer, bone disease, etc. If you lump some of the neurological diseases together, it comes out second in burden. So that's not a surprise either. The problem with neurological diseases is they can be hard to diagnose. Now, what about the influence of comorbidities on death Well, as is fairly self-evident, the larger the burden, the greater the chance of reduced life expectancy. How does this play out in the context then of the brain and ageing and dementia in particular, or cognitive impairment if it's mild? Well, we know that age, so in Alzheimer's, for example, people talk about Alzheimer's disease, but it's actually usually Alzheimer's plus a whole host of comorbid conditions, most important of which is vascular disease. And that's increasingly becoming very evident in relation to HIV in the brain and its associated cognitive impairment. Additionally, there are other conditions that can interplay with that burden of disease and cause expression of dementia or cognitive impairment. So the picture is becoming a little bit more complicated. The classical picture of what HIV can do to the brain, I think, is now muddier because of the comorbid conditions. How's that translating into what we're seeing in the population in general? Well, in terms of US data, we're seeing, unfortunately, more patients in residential care. And of those patients who are in residential care, a large number, increasingly large number, have cognitive impairment that's been labelled as dementia other. There are some that are labelled as Alzheimer's disease, and that's another aspect of HIV and ageing in the brain that I think is evolving. This is not just confined to the US and developed countries. Certainly in South Africa, in rural South Africa, the burden of HIV in terms of cognitive impairment is significantly higher as you get older. Sort of dovetails nicely with what I've said before, and that is now we're looking at a multi-hit model in the brain, just as we are with Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. It's a multi-hit phenomenon. We proposed this model some years ago now based on our MR spectroscopy data, and it certainly makes sense. Not only do you have multiple hits in different parts of the brain by different processes that are age-related, but there's additive effects in the same part of the brain. And I'll draw your attention now and emphasise it later. The frontal lobe, I think, is increasingly important. I mentioned parenthetically the issue of Alzheimer's disease and HIV, and I know it's a thorny one, and recognising that HIV associated neurocognitive disorder now is multifaceted, nonetheless, we have in our study that's under review have found amyloid deposition, which is not uniform in a small number of patients that we've studied, but there are some patients in whom amyloid deposition is at the same level of Alzheimer's patients, and at least in one case, much greater. It is a varied phenotype, so you have to be careful. In our particular patients, they were deliberately older than the ones that have been published. And if those of you who know the literature understand that thus far, the published literature, barring one case, would say that you don't have an increase in Alzheimer's, at least by amyloid PET scanning. Well, our data contradict that, and it's because we've deliberately chosen patients who are older and looked for different, at least other factors that may influence that are more classical in the expression of Alzheimer's. So, now the next part of the talk is, having identified that age is important, comorbidities are important, what are the data in terms of that's out there that actually says, yes, the brain's ageing faster than it should be? So this part of the talk is essentially a literature review from ATTAIN under Lucette's supervision and mine. We had lofty goals. We thought we'd be able to determine the degree of the ageing effect and cognitive function, prevalence and incidence, and then address issues of premature ageing and or accentuated ageing. I'll spare you the suspense. We really haven't broached any of those aims. The data are just a mess. So we had a number of inclusion criteria, which included looking at cohorts that were after 1996, we weren't particularly fussy in terms of whether the patients were virally suppressed or not. We did want them the studies to be published in English, and we wanted reasonable sample sizes, but it turns out, as I'll show you, that we were a bit too generous. Looking at this PRISMA flow diagram, you can see we started off with 633 studies and ended up, after culling, and we were fairly rigorous but not too stringent, we ended up with 36 studies, just to show you that a lot of stuff gets published that shouldn't really ever be published. And of those 36 final studies, surprisingly, 14 had no HIV controls, which is really disappointing. And then 22 had controls, but then even in those 22 studies, 16 were cross-sectional. And cross-sectional data are obviously important for hypothesis generating, but shouldn't be used to necessarily validate a hypothesis. But nonetheless, that's what people do. So we actually finally had 6 longitudinal studies. And as you can see, the weight of those studies, if you just treat them equally, I think points towards, yes, there is an effect on HIV and brain function according to age. The studies themselves came from largely from the US, and the sample sizes were disappointingly quite small, barring 3 studies. And why is that important? Well, again, most of these studies are published and without rigorous methodology to look at the appropriateness of the power. And it depends on what you're looking for, but you'd like a reasonable number of patients in your study. Depending on covariates, et cetera, it's several hundred. What we found, and I'll show you that later, is about 500 would be the, or at least 500 in your cohort would be needed to have a definitive answer in a longitudinal study. In the interest of time, I'll skip over this. But I'll just say briefly that the patients were not uniformly virally suppressed. The age cutoff was quite variable, and only a few patients sort of understandably had patients that were older than 60. I'll skip over that. And as I said, there were 6 longitudinal studies. How they assessed neurocognition was also variable, unfortunately, and to the point where we were unable to do a meta-analysis. And as I said, the age, the issue of how you define what's old is not clear. The neuropsychological methods, if you look at all the studies across the literature, were performed reasonably well. So they tried, by and large, to have a global neuropsych assessment. Some of them used focused studies to assess neurocognitive function. That's a problem because if you tailor your neuropsych assessment to what we know in the pre-CART era were the areas and functions that were disturbed by HIV, then you're looking through a narrow set of glasses. You really have to have a much broader set of neuropsychological testing instruments, simply because as you get older, you have these morbidity effects affecting different parts of the brain. If you look at the quality appraisal of the various studies, by and large, they're not too bad, with the big problem, however, being neurocognitive assessment and how that was defined appropriately. And again, even the longitudinal studies, by and large, had this same core problem. When, even in the longitudinal studies, again, you had a problem with a varying hand prevalence, and that, again, is an issue in terms of how you define and... Well, hand is well-defined, but how you actually implement that definition at a practical level. So some people go by clinical assessment, some people use neuropsychological assessment, some people include imaging. And then, of course, there are the population characteristics which can completely confound your responses. So if you have patients who are relatively early in their disease, you're not going to find much in the way of hand. But if you have patients who are older and have had the disease for some time, then you will have a higher prevalence. The lower the CD4 nadir is a marker still. So what did they find? Despite the variations, essentially, if you had a longitudinal study design, you're more likely to find an effect of accelerated brain aging the larger the sample size. And I mentioned this before, so you really have to look at large numbers greater than 500 to have an appropriate power. And then you have to have appropriate older samples of patients and a lower CD4 nadir. The longer the duration, the lower nadir CD4 may be a surrogate of the duration, but not necessarily. In the interest of time, I'll skip over that. So the conclusions essentially, I think, focus on saying, in general, there is an effect. It's checkered. The data are not homogeneous. There are a whole host of methodological issues that unfortunately confound more definitive assessment. But I think if you just take a gestalt of what's been published, then the weight of evidence would say, yes, brain aging happens in HIV. But all those studies really paid little or scant attention to comorbidities and their effects. And we all know that that's extremely important, as I've already alluded to. There's one study that has tried to incorporate that, but that's a cross-sectional study. That's a CHARTER study in the US. And you can see the effect of comorbidities. So they can be either contributing, but you can still get a signal that it's hand, or they can be confounding. Now, at a clinical level, you might say, if you've got a confounding comorbidity, then you can't necessarily measure the outcome, namely hand or some sort of mutated form of hand. But I think in this day and age, and if you go by what is present in the other non-HIV dementia literature, you have to live with your confounds and your comorbidities. You can't exclude them. That's not what happens in clinical practice, and I think we have to move that into the clinical research field and accept it. Are there basic science? So I've given you literature review data. Are there basic science data that also support accelerated aging? There are, both at a basic science level and also at an imaging level. So this is a study from Pfefferbaum, which has shown that alcohol abuse will compound the effect of HIV-associated neurocognitive disorder and add about a 14-year-fold effect on of aging on the brain. We also looked at our small study and noted in our latency work that in a population of patients, those who had hand had clearly more comorbidities. That's not a surprise. Interestingly enough, in our cohort, there's a clear, but reassuringly and not surprisingly, influence of cardiovascular disease on hand. And, sorry. That should have been off. And then when we looked at the same cohort, using spectroscopy and this study, diffusion tensor imaging, we found that the cardiovascular impact was significant in patients who had HIV brain disease, and that the burden of the additive effect was in the frontal lobe. And this is further borne out by our data using, again, diffusion tensor imaging, where we look now at the white matter tracts, and again, there's a significant effect from cardiovascular disease on HIV and on HIV that's already affected the brain. So I've deliberately left a few minutes for questioning, but lots of people have contributed to this study, including those from St. Vincent's Hospital, various research staff, and from Neurof and neuroimaging, and as I mentioned, the PhD work of Hattain. Thank you.